Coming up next, Derek Christensen. Thank you.
Thank you. Who here has heard me speak in this type of setting before, out of curiosity? I can speak pretty quickly once I get rolling. Everything is on a PowerPoint. If there's something that you don't see in a PowerPoint, there's really only a couple of new pictures. We can get you the PDF. If there's a website on there, the URL, you can click through it. So, you know, try to take notes in a not so thorough manner and you'll probably keep up.
Thanks, Derek.
Lessons learned. I want to put a couple caveats because I'm going to go kind of on the other end of the spectrum of where John was. I'm going to kind of dig into some micro, especially around the management of vegetable production. And it's really hard to give you a full picture of what we're doing on the farm. And so even if we get kind of focused in on one practice or the other, I don't want you to lose sight of the complexity that we're attempting to bring into our operation. So if we go light on biology, I can share with you, we don't really spread large amounts of compost because we don't have a great compost source, but we do a lot with biodynamic preparations, barrel compost, small amounts. We're doing lots and lots of inoculations in the greenhouse, in the fields. Just make sure that as we're deep, we can kind of think about that systems approach that was just presented. So I'm going to talk about early season production and dry weather production. I'm a vegetable grower. We crop commercially about 6 or 7 acres of vegetables in South Dartmouth. I support my family through that work. My wife raises our daughters. I sort of help out in the wintertime. And we have a couple people that work with us on the farm. It's a classic startup operation. I didn't have a lot of money. I had a decent amount of knowledge from farming and managing other farms before we started our farm. And I'm still farming in a kind of stupid way, which is to say I use my body a lot. It might be stupid, but I also really like it. I'm young, kind of feels good. And it's also in a very early stage. We just moved our operation last year. So we've literally been on our new land, part of it for 4 or 5 seasons, but for the majority of that new land, which you'll see a picture of in a second, we've only been there for about 12 months. And so our production systems there are very much in that early genesis stage. And people a lot of times will ask us about animals, and we don't carry any animals in the farm. In the future, there will be animals back on this farm. It's an old dairy farm. It's well suited for grazing. I hope not to be the one managing those animals because I just have enough complexity in my life. So a lot of this kind of bigger vision, what I'm aware of is we're going to get there over time. But for me, the kind of quintessential question is, what is our quality right now? And also, what is our profitability or the farm income right now? Because I need to support my family doing this. So, you know, it's a little bit maybe guided by economics in ways that maybe some of the other presentations haven't been. This is an aerial view of the farm, and it just kind of gives you a perspective, which is, it's about a 120-acre piece of land, a little more than half of it's wooded. This was the old dairy farm. The high school for town got built here in the 90s. That used to be part of the farm. And we bought a little house that I say is not on the farm, but it's about a half mile away from the farm gate. And in New York, that was really on the farm. So it's just we have a bunch of houses between our farm and ourselves. And we're cropping, as I said, about 6 or 7 acres of veggies pretty intensively. I should say as well that we're not mechanized. And I need one more person to work with me this summer, so if anybody wants to become a labor supporter of Bricks Bounty Farm, you can talk to me afterwards. Everything that we do on the farm, the lens at which I look at it is this idea that our fertility investments can be one of the biggest levers for us to be profitable. And so we have always, and even on leased land, we've prioritized those investments. And it's partially because we want that response on a quality to be there year one. But it's also partially on the idea that everything that we do on the farm, you'll see a picture of a tomato in a second, it's a ton of labor. I don't care if you're mechanized and you're doing water wheel cultivation and you got a nice cultivation system, there's labor involved in maintaining those pieces of equipment. And I want to be selfish and maximize as much return for that labor as we can. And over the years, we've figured out that investing in fertility is a pretty good way to do it. To give you perspective, this year the farm budget may be about $140,000, and we will probably spend between $12,000 and $14,000 on fertility inputs, not just the labor. And I call fertility inputs everything from Vermont compost potting mix, which we love, to our cover crop seed, anything that's going towards improving the quality of the food that we're growing. So, I've been growing vegetables for a little more than 12 years. I started in 2002. I've been farming full time, except for one winter since then. And I tell people I kind of know enough to know I don't know a lot, and I still kind of humble and awe at the natural system. And so my approach a lot of times is thinking to what was just spoken is, let's make sure that the minerals and the biology are there so that natural system can do what it needs to do and kind of get out of the way. And we're also, with that lens of a commercial operator, is we want to get crops to market in a timely fashion. And we're in southeastern Massachusetts. We're right on the coast. We're in a microclimate where in May it can be 55 or 60 degrees on the farm, and I can drive 20 miles inland and it can be 75 or 80 degrees. We can sometimes, if we have a southerly breeze off the cool water, it's slow to warm up. So the reason I wanted to talk about this early season production is we're doing a lot on our farm to make sure that we get good production even though we don't necessarily have warmth readily available. So this is a picture. I have a few pictures in the slide from this year. These were lettuce mix and heads all transplanted out late April last year. Put row cover on them to kind of stimulate and make sure the heat is in that root zone. Couple cultivations, basically two, with one just hitting the wheel tracks to kind of keep the wheel tracks clean. Came in and started to harvest the first week of June for our CSA. We market everything. That's another caveat, just to give you a good idea about the farm, is we do a roadside stand. It's honor system. About half our business is through the roadside stand. It's completely unmanned. So in the height of the summer, we're always selling vegetables 7 days a week, but we're rarely at the farm stand. And I do the same thing with our CSA. So the nice thing about owning your own farm is you get to kind of figure out who you want your customers to be. And we figured out that our best customers are the ones that don't necessarily need to interact with me on a weekly basis. Because I'd rather be out there on a Monday afternoon, you know, getting transplanting work done or some cultivation work done. And so, you know, they will see us fleetingly, but to be perfectly honest, I mean, there are times where it's October and I see somebody at the CSA tent who I have not seen literally the entire season, which kind of flies at the whole idea of knowing your farmer. But I've decided that over time, those interactions, I like to have them on my time. So I can kind of structure it. I can pop into the CSA tent and talk to folks if I want to talk to them, and otherwise they just show up and get their veggies. So I farmed on the vineyard for a couple years before we went out to New York, and the time that I was on the vineyard, I was using a lot of bagged CPS 724 fertilizers, and it was at that point where, you know, we successfully figured out how to cultivate a crop and plant at the right time of year and, you know, keep the deer away, and, you know, you can grow vegetables. But I kind of struggled with this idea of importing things. So at the time, I was looking for a new gig off-island, and I found Hawthorne Valley Farm in New York, which is a biodynamic operation. And I sort of had some inclinations towards biodynamics, so I thought I'd check it out. And that idea of a closed-loop system that I think is so central in the unique farm organism to biodynamics, it certainly guides us. But what I'm aware of, and Steiner talked about, the need for remediation at certain times. And I'm going to show you some pictures in a little bit where we're working on land that just got flipped a year ago that was hay fields that had pretty much zero fertility inputs for the last two decades. And that is a much different soil environment than something that you've been managing for 5, 10, or 15, or 20 years. And so the approach to what you're going to do in that situation for me is dramatically different. Ultimately, for us, this relationship with our community, even though we don't necessarily like to talk to our customers, is it's what we're here for. And I was thinking last night, because I was thinking about a good testimonial, right? Everybody has testimonials from their customers. And this summer we had somebody was gifted a CSA share. Normally I don't recommend people give people CSA shares because it seems like it's a disaster. Because, you know, you have to have the time and energy to cook. But somebody we knew in the community gifted a CSA share to somebody who I didn't know at all. And they showed up and I started talking with them, and it was like the second or third week. I ran into the share. I said, "Oh, you know, how are you enjoying things?" He's like, "Man, this is a ton of veggies. We give out a ton of veggies, right? We're the kind of people that say we only want to deal with CSA customers that are totally committed to eating vegetables, and you're going to eat a lot." And he was a single customer, so we have different share sizes, but you know, probably in June it's 10 or 12 items, you know, 2-3 heads of lettuce. But he said, "You know, I want to tell you something." He says, so he's a gentleman had stomach cancer and was hospitalized for some of his blood iron levels in that springtime. And you know, I don't know like what degree of health or wherever he's been, but I gathered things hadn't been terrifically great. He said, "I don't know what it is. All I've been doing is just eating your vegetables the last 2 weeks, and my blood levels, my iron levels went up more in those 2 weeks. They had a better increase than I've had in the last 2 years." And you know, it was just one little thing. You ever can pick that little anecdote. But that's really what we're talking about, right? We're talking about nourishment of our community in hopefully a sustainable manner. So that's what we're going to try to do. Our tagline on the farm changes every year. And I wrote a letter to our CSA members, the people that have joined this year, and this is the one that came out last week. And it's, "At Brick's Body Farm, we don't invest in chemicals." I actually gave him a copy, you know, cut out of Schedule F, which has chemicals as the second line on the Schedule F. Said, "I've never put anything but zero on that line since I've started filling out Schedule Fs. But we invest in soils, we invest in systems, and we invest in skilled labor. Those are, to me, the heart of sustainable agriculture." So we're going to talk briefly about minerals, microbes, and management. Dan used to always talk about minerals and microbes, and at some point I think I started putting management in those trio of things. And you know, thank heavens we got John now, because we all realize we're not doing a good enough job to understand our soils chemistry. That realm of soil testing, there are a lot more people that are starting to do this total testing, the aqua regia soil testing. And I encourage you, hopefully we're all going to go back and then maybe we're going to share information with each other and get a better idea of what that underlying stuff is. The key for me with soil tests is they're a tool to make fertilizer and amendment decisions. If you're going to spend money on the bulk order, you're going to spend money with your fertilizer company, it's a really nice idea to have an idea of if there's something there that's in deficit. The microbes, that's that humility I don't fully understand, but I do understand there's a heck of a lot of interconnectedness. And they provide that natural intelligence. And our approach has always been to obliterate the microbes through some tillage, and then to try to do our best to compensate for that. We'll talk about that in a little bit in a sec. And then the management. We were at a conversation maybe about a year and a half ago, and John Paul Cortens from Roxbury Farm was there, and he talked about some studies they'd done on tomato quality in the Hudson River Valley. And he said, "You know, our soils on the soil quality Cornell soil test are always the lowest of all these guys that were doing our tests, and yet our tomato quality was the best." You know, he's a humble man in his own way, but he's also a damn good farmer. And that management aspect of things is really critical. And you know, agriculture is the science or art or practice of cultivating the soil. You know, we have a huge role in figuring where this is going. And that emphasis for me is why humus might be that long-term essential management goal. The now is also really important. We want to make sure that something's there right then and there. So here's a picture of that. We took on new land. This is a field of winter squash. Not all winter squash. We had maybe 7,000 square feet, small little beds. But, and we were picking rock out of this field, maybe 100 ton of rock this year. It was a rocky field. That land on a Malic soil test had less than 1% potassium, kind of very low level of nutrients. It had been a hay field that had been mined for hay for 20 plus years. They hadn't had cows on that land since the early 80s. And we need to grow a crop this year. So we're going to think about that fertility protocol. What that has done, I was talking with Noah last night, he said one thing that's shifted as we've invested in fertility is how we relate to cultivation has really changed. We still cultivate. But we're never cultivating nearly to the degree that I used to cultivate when I was on other farms. And it's partially because we're getting canopy to fill in, we're getting crops to grow in a way that takes that cultivation step away. So like our winter squash is generally two cultivations. There's the one on the pictures on the 19th. That's our final cultivation. We did a side dressing. They had been cultivated twice. There it is on the 25th of July, starting to fill in nicely. 30th completely filled in. Got a nice crop of delicata and butternut and things like that. What we did to do that, that field was plowed. We do some sprays, boron sprays in the springtime. We do biobuilders. We're talking about those in a second. Dry minerals, foliars, whatever it is on a fertility standpoint, we're going to figure it out and spend the time and energy so that all the other work that's going to go into it is well paid. So let's talk about this early season production. One of the things that I try to remember and focus on for folks is that you can be in the same exact spot, different points of the calendar, and the soil underneath you, especially the biological activity of that soil underneath you, is dramatically different. Whether it's the soil temperature, whether it's the moisture, whether it's that microbial population, all of that is going to be dependent upon the time and place of that year. And why we have this understanding that biology can be totally influenced by our plants. For me, as a commercial grower that wants to have a really nice CSA share the second week of June, I want to get farm stand customers coming in there. June is a nice time of year to sell vegetables. We have a lot of home gardeners in Dartmouth. If we can give people like cucumbers the end of June before they have homegrown cucumbers, all those, we can beat them to their home garden by 2 or 3 weeks. We have these constant stream of customers coming in. Same thing with nice full-grown heads of lettuce early in the season. You know, they might have planted their lettuce on Mother's Day and they don't have lettuce on the 7th of June. We can give them that, but we need to do something maybe to jumpstart the system. Here are the classic concerns of early season production in New England. It's cold and wet soils, right? It's not normally a limited amount of solar energy. You might have a cloudy May. There are some cloudy Mays. But it's not a lack of solar energy that's slowing us down in the springtime. Anybody want to take disagreement with that? Anybody who grows in a high tunnel and has production going into March and April and May can testify to what plenty of solar energy as long as there's heat there to do that work. So normally it's early season nitrogen activity because the microbes are slow to wake up. The mineralization of our organic matter hasn't kicked in. There's all the good data out there. The universities have done looking at how quickly that organic matter is mineralized. Phosphorus can be an issue because it's not very mobile on our soils, and the microbes that might access that phosphorus, if they're not mobile, you got to get the roots growing. So over the years that I farmed in New York, that was probably the best example of that, because Hawthorne Valley is in a valley that's in a little bit of the highlands from the Hudson River Valley. And we'd go down to Roxbury in March, and their winter rye would be 2-3 weeks ahead of us, even though they were 15 miles away. Same situation where we are on the coast. If I go inland just a little ways, see those spring cover crops, life has come back to that location much quicker than it's come back to my coastal location. So, you know, you got to think about your geographical location. If you have a nice south-facing slope, that might help you out in the springtime. If you're elevated, that could be a hindrance. So let's talk about these minerals, and then we'll get back to our microclimates, what we're going to do about it. I am constantly attempting to reconnect with our land-grant universities and kind of re-engage them and check in with them on information that they're sharing. And Cornell has a fact sheet on sulfur. So one of the things I talk a lot about is sulfur because we've done a good job of cleaning it up out of our smokestacks. So if you're taking this, I'm not going to add things to my garden and soil and farm approach. If you were gardening or farming in the 60s or 70s, you were getting different levels of sulfur than you're getting today. Sulfur plays a critical role in protein development, which can make a big difference in how tasty our plants are to insects. Hugh Lovell talks a lot about it kind of helping to get the biological environment going, right? Bacteria was talked about with its relationship to sulfur just yesterday. Here's Cornell's fact sheet. It says a deficiency of sulfur is more likely to occur on acidic sandy soils, soils with low organic matter, high nitrogen input, soils that are cold and dry in the spring, which decreases sulfur mineralization from soil organic matter. So this isn't—it shouldn't be a controversial subject matter. The key for us is it's not going to take necessarily a ton of energy to jumpstart that system. It depends a little bit on how much you want to push it. We know from our management practices, and we're not certified organic, but we're using organic practices, so to speak, that we can push how quickly we want the gas to go. And in the springtime, that might mean we're supplementing with some sort of nitrogen, or blood meal is probably the best under cold conditions in an organic soil situation. Last year, we ran a test, partially because I just wanted to see, we're doing a cabbage workshop. So we split a bed of cabbage, 1,000 square feet, into four quadrants. And we took one quadrant and just put an additional pound of blood meal, would have been equivalent to 4 pounds per 1,000 square feet, just in that quadrant alone. It was the only thing that happened differently in that part of the field. And that was, surprise, surprise, when we were harvesting cabbage for the second week of our CSA, that was where we went to pick those cabbage heads. They were the ones that had matured, rounded up, and were the fullest that second week of June. Right next to them, right across the bed, just that 18 inches apart, things were not yet at a state of maturity. So from a management perspective, we can, especially if we're going to have this eye on the prize of getting somewhere, getting to market quickly, we can do stuff, and you know, the sustainability of this, you might call into question sometimes, but to me, very targeted use of these inputs in the springtime, again, it's about the financial sustainability of the farm, this can be a great, great investment. So we often do what we call a bio builder in the springtime. We're put down a little bit of fish because we're near New Bedford, so we have organic gem just nearby. We can go get 55-gallon drums in the pickup truck. And we're come out and we're spray in the springtime. I do this normally twice, normally late March, depending on how the soils have warmed up. And we do a backpack sprayer. It allows us to walk our fields at the time of year that we don't necessarily always have to walk our fields. Gives us a chance, if we have a crew, to introduce them to different nooks and crannies of the farm. And our biobuilder is oftentimes some sort of biological inoculant. A lot of times it's compost tea from our own barrel compost, biodynamic compost. Some fish fertilizer, which also has phosphoric acid as a stabilizing agent. You're not allowed to use phosphoric acid. You can't, we were talking about Coca-Cola the other day on the farm, you can't just use phosphoric acid in organic, but it can be used to stabilize fish products. So if you want to bring a little bit of phosphorus into that system, we're not talking about huge quantities of stuff. Couple gallons of this to the acre. We do it, you know, so we do it 2 quarts to a backpack. It's a pretty fishy backpack. It's almost, you know, half a gallon of fish to a backpack. And a little bit of molasses, a little bit of sugar to drive the microbial population. And we're spray that out once, late March, and then we're come out and spray that right before we're going to do any spring tillage. Oftentimes right on top of our fertilizer so that we're bringing some biology in contact with that fertilizer. Sometimes it doesn't work, it always depends on how the practice of the day is. But in a perfect world, we spread our mineral mix starter fertilizer and then we'll come out and spray with a backpack and then we'll turn that lightly into the soil and we go from there. All right. Is there anybody that isn't comfortable with the concept of phosphorus kind of being difficult to mobilize in the springtime, or if, you know, that classic picture of a phosphorus deficient broccoli in the spring that's got a little bit of purple in the leaves? All right, what are we going to do about it, right? We're never going to operate, even though we're going to talk about one mineral, we're never going to operate strictly within the paradigm that that's the only thing we're going to care about. And why biological activity, we just talked about biobuilder, is going to play a role, we're also going to think about what are the other minerals necessary to make that phosphorus do the work. And we could probably pick every other mineral on the spectrum, but here are three that we say, if we're going to get phosphorus to do its thing in the springtime, these are three that we want to keep in mind. Boron plays a role. If you want to get into the science of it, I did some research, there's a nice thing from A&L Labs up in Canada. Boron plays a role in how phosphorus is mobilized into the roots of plants. And if you have deficient boron in your soils, you're not going to get the phosphorus that's there into the plants on the same level. Biology might be able to work around that to some degree, but where is that biological activity if the soil temperature is 50 degrees and it's middle of April? Hugh Lovell's done a lot of work looking at copper, and this is where he got into total mineral assay, because he was finding situations where he was seeing phosphorus deficiency in crops, and then he went and, not just doing a Malik test, but went and did a total analysis and would found that where those phosphorus deficiencies were exhibiting in the tissue of the crops were these fields that he was working with that were completely devoid of copper. And on the long term, maybe we can allow for some sort of transmutation or whatever, but the short term is copper sulfate's allowed in organic production. Putting 5 or 10 pounds of copper sulfate onto the acre to help get that copper availability that helps with the phosphorus, that was Hugh's answer. Zinc's been long well understood to have a role in phosphorus mobilization as well. So the idea here is it's way beyond the NPK. We're not going to just talk about NPK. We're going to talk about that full spectrum when we're looking at fertility in the springtime. So we do some consulting just a little bit here and there. I work with Julie. And one of the conversations around nitrogen a few years ago was, he needs nitrogen. You need to get going. And one thing I said to her is, you know, row cover is free nitrogen if you don't mind managing row cover in the springtime. It is going to warm your soils up, and it's going to get the biology going, and it's going to start to mineralize your organic matter. It's going to release nitrogen.
And it worked.
Oh, and it worked. We knew it would work. Right, I'm in a windy environment, so we kind of really have to be thoughtful about getting involved with row cover. It's a really tricky relationship. You know, right? 50 mile per hour winds and row cover, not really fun. But we use it in the springtime. And what we found consistently is it really can help, and I'll show some pictures in just a sec, it really can help to get that plant going. Get through a stress period. Get it tapped into the growth pattern. Again, thinking about all that solar energy that's there in April and May. These investments that I'm making, I'll talk about in a second, is really about increasing that photosynthetic potential. Having more leaf size. Having more roots that can go get stuff. So what are we going to do in the springtime? We're going to increase the soil and air temperature. Row cover is a great way to do that. Raising our beds. Elevate things. Judicious use of tillage can warm our soils. Anything that we're going to do, we're going to think about the pros and cons in the short and the long term. The other thing about our farm, we only do one farmer's market off the farm, so we never have to hold back in growing big things. And so this was that lettuce picture at the beginning of the field that was pictured from May. This is one of our lettuce heads. It's probably a 2-star by the looks of it, just shy of 3 pounds. Okay. We're gonna talk about dry production in a second, and that'll hopefully really make you say, that's a decent head of lettuce. Nice thing about this is we've been working one of our fields for 4 or 5 seasons on this farm. It's got a much different base to start with. It's oftentimes where we start our fields. And boy, this year we could tell you, cut and dry, the holding capacity of the lettuce in that field versus the new field that we just put in our production this year, in terms of the taste quality of that lettuce in third, fourth week of June, dramatically different. Romaine heads that would just sit there waiting and waiting for you to harvest as the time allowed. Again, thinking about those investments, right? Everything that we do on the farm, we don't want to waste our energy. If you're growing lettuce heads and you're letting them bolt in your field, that's a huge waste of energy. Or I call it expensive cover cropping. If we can make a fertility input decision that gives us a prolonged harvest period for our lettuce heads, it makes the management that much easier. All right, so, you know, just to give this perspective. So I started farming at Waltham Fields and outside of Boston. It's an old field station. Farmed there for a few years on the vineyard where my wife is from, out at Hawthorne Valley, and then started Brix Bounty Farm in Dartmouth in 2008. We actually moved farms last year onto new land. And I'd farmed for 6 years on incredibly wet soils. It was a classic situation where I needed a place to farm and there was a piece of farmland available, and I thought, oh, maybe I can manage my way through these. And we did enjoy certain valuable improvements, but we also, like in 2013, we had, 10 inches of rain in 10 days in June. And, you know, we probably lost $5,000, $6,000 worth of broccoli, lettuce, and spring crops because they were completely underwater for extended periods of time. So we moved on to our new piece. We actually haven't signed any lease. We're going to sign a 10 or 15 year lease. We bought a house, so we have a pretty good confidence we're going to sign this darn lease. But for me, it was relationship. There's no way I would have had access to this piece of property, not being from Dartmouth, until I actually moved into the town, spent some time growing food on this other marginal piece. And now it's opened the doors up to me. And it's nice, because once you get established, I was telling somebody this summer, I'm out there hoeing the field, and there's a conventional guy in town who decided to drop a field about a half a mile from us. And as soon as they did, the landlord came by and said, "Hey, you want to rent this field?" We passed it on to another farmer, but I said, there's no way that relationship would have been introduced until we had sort of an establishment. And the reason I talk about this is, so we do I call them like farm management apprenticeships, these two-year positions. And for me, the value of social capital cannot be understated when you're thinking about starting a farm. And when we left New York, it was sort of at a pretty strong pause, because we had a lot of social ties just in 2 years at Hawthorne Valley, folks that were ready to invest and help us buy farmland, And I don't think enough can be said about thinking about it when you're in this stage of thinking about starting a farm, about how valuable it is to build that trust, those relationships that you get from being present. So we often encourage people, try and farm places, get around, but once you think you know where you want to be, really kind of sink your teeth into things. We hope to be where we're going to be for a really long time. I would like a 15-year lease, so my girls, we have two daughters when my wife is pregnant. Hopefully they can go to high school in Dartmouth. We don't have to move the family mid-season. All right, so a lot of this is kind of that lens of economic investment. And for me, this is that focus on improvements which increase the photosynthetic activity and allow for large, healthy root systems. When we're looking at things that we're doing on the farm, we're thinking about solar energy, which is totally abundant almost any time of the year, frankly. What can we do to make sure that we're getting and capturing that solar energy? Irrigation systems, oftentimes a really good investment, especially if you're growing high-value vegetables. Deer fencing or preventing defoliation. That's if I'm doing work with gardeners and consulting, then fencing is almost the first thing I almost always talk about, because it's not much fun to do a bunch of work. We have to install a deer fence, I guess. I'd like to negotiate with our landowner to be able to hunt, but we haven't been able to get over that hurdle. Didn't really want to kill deer on our land, so we lost some lettuce heads this fall to deer and stuff like that. We're going to invest in deer fencing. It's a really smart investment, because if there's heads there that are growing, whether it's deer or beans, things that are attractive, if you don't have the leaf there, you can't do much with the solar energy. Similar story with insect pressure. What are we doing from a fertility standpoint to protect ourselves from insect pressure? If you have flea beetles or Colorado potato beetle or any of these bugs that are eating the leaves, that's going to impact that photosynthetic efficiency. All right, so the caveat is irrigation is typically a very, very smart investment. Almost universally, it's like one of the smartest things to invest in if you're going to be a commercial grower. However, there are situations where investments might not be warranted, sometimes short-term leases, low-value crops. And I'm going to talk you through what we've been doing, because we do hardly any irrigation on the farm. And it was initially because we signed a 3-year lease on that property, and putting a well in a property that was relatively wet with a 3-year lease seemed like a waste of money. And then we extended that lease, and after a while we had paid enough money to the town for town water on washing vegetables. And I was like, well, maybe it hadn't been such a waste of money. So if I had gone back in a perfect world, I would have spent the money on a well just for washing vegetables 6 years ago, but we didn't. And then, last year, we moved on to new land. It seems like it would make sense to spend money on a well. But we're also brand new to this property. We don't truly have an idea of how we want this land to develop. And one thing I like to do is not make any super major decisions about land management that first year that you're on a property. Plus, if you're moving a farm, if anybody's moved a farm, it's a lot of work and there's a lot of things to do. And you got to pick your battles. And so we said, you know what, we're not going to worry about well stuff. And the other thing is NRCS a lot of times has resources made available for doing wells. And so we want to, you know, maybe do a contract with NRCS to get some money. Over the years, we've grown quite successful crops without irrigation. One of the key things I will say, though, is that rate of growth is almost always going to be impacted by that lack of irrigation when things get really dry. And I want to stress that because we grow for a CSA and a roadside stand. I have complete flexibility of when my crops mature and when I need to get them to anybody. I'm never having to satisfy an order for something. I don't have to get something to a market on a certain date. I might encourage myself to do it, but I'm, you know, if my cabbage heads take an extra 2 weeks in the summertime, it's no big deal. So having that flexibility in my marketing allows me to, you know, take this on. If I was doing, you know, wholesale production, and I probably wouldn't recommend this. All right, we're going to talk about rainfall in just a second, but I want to break for, see if there's anybody who has any questions about this approach. Is there anybody here that's farming vegetables on more than 5 acres without irrigation? Just out of curiosity. Okay. All right, I'm going to come back to this in a second. We're talking about what we did for rainfall at Bricks Bounty Farm last year. So we keep records of things, and then, you know, the internet keeps records of things. So the other day I went back and looked at things. Here's our experience of summer last year. A lot of rain in the springtime. We're warm enough at the coast. A lot of times we don't get snow. Last year we only had one really good snowstorm. But most of our rain, January, February, it's rain. It wasn't snow. And then we had a 4-inch rainstorm on March 30th when your soils are not really super receptive to water, right? 4 inches spread out through the month of April. We had a nice big storm on May 1st. It was a cool spring for southeastern Massachusetts. I think most people in Massachusetts were cool last spring. It was a cool spring and it was wet. And then on May 1st, the tap just turned off. So from May 1st last year till July 4th, we had maybe about 1.5 inches of rain. So without irrigation. That lettuce head that you saw was produced with no irrigation during that time period, but a lot of early amounts of water, really about emphasizing that root system to being able to access the groundwater that was still there. And then if anybody got rain on July 4th, we got a little over 6.5 inches in one day. So we'd gone literally almost 2 months with 1.5 inches, and then we had 6.5 in 24 hours. Got another rainstorm 2 weeks later, and then it went dry again. You know, these cyclical cycles for us, we often have dry periods. When I farmed on the vineyard, it was almost like consistent that you could go from almost Memorial Day to Labor Day with almost very little rain. So here's a picture of some crops. I don't always get the camera out, but I occasionally have it out. So I took a few photos and I tried to get a snapshot of a few things that kind of talk about this. So this is crops grown under without irrigation under that scenario. So basically a couple half-inch storms in May and then completely dry, got warm. So these are onions on the left-hand side, tropeas, purplettes, things of that nature. We row covered those onions. They got put out the first week of May. It was cool. It had been wet. We row covered them partially to keep root maggots out of the equation, but it was also to really get that biology going. We like to have an allium in our share every single week. So normally the first week of the season is scallions, then we go into scapes for 2 weeks, and then we go maybe to scallions. But we want to get a nice good size mini onion by 1st of July. So for us to push that production, row cover is a really nice situation. Those onions, again, purplettes, those finished before we had the rain. We had that one rainstorm in July, but they were pretty much getting picked as we were going through that. To give you an idea of yields, I know some farmers aren't good at tracking yields. We don't keep completely accurate yields. What I have is a harvest sheet, and every so often we go out and do a very accurate estimate. And we're harvesting our purplettes, but we're nowhere near progressing through the bed as quickly as I thought, right? One of these classic experiences, like the yields are really nice. We were supposed to be done with those, and we're like halfway through the bed. So I went out on a Sunday. I was picking for the CSA the next day, said, okay, well, we need to get some perplets. Let's see what they're at. 12 bed feet. These are mini onions. We were able to get, I think it was about 48, 50 pints of onions. It was like 50 or 60 pounds out of 12 bed feet. These are mini onions. This picture, these other pictures were taken on the 29th of June. This is Sylvesta lettuce. That was planted out probably the second or third week of May. Maybe a little bit later than that. That it had maybe a half inch during its life cycle in the field. And, you know, no problem getting a crop. The emphasis there for us is to make sure that the minerals are there for the root system to go. We want to see a transplant go in the ground and within 24 or 48 hours see an explosion of roots. Those transplants are going and trying to make as big of a root zone to get nutrients, get minerals, get water as possible. Here's use of row cover on the farm. You'll see a picture of eggplant again in a second. That's eggplant under row cover. It likes heat on the 29th of June. So again, that microclimate modification. We're not particularly warm. For us, we started covering eggplant because we had eggplant flea beetles a couple years ago. We hadn't managed our way through that yet. So it's really nice just to throw some row cover on eggplant. That row cover does a couple things for us because we're hoeing things by hand. It allows what weeds do germinate underneath that row cover, because it's in a pretty lush environment, those weeds are pretty damn delicate. And they're really easy to cultivate out. So let's think about water's role in plant growth. We all know that water's needed to grow plants, needed for photosynthesis, right? Transpiration, the movement of water from the root systems up to the plants, that actually uses about 90% of the water the plants use. Very little of the water the plants use is actually for photosynthesis. That transpiration, that air exchange at the leaf, is how carbon dioxide comes into the leaf to go photosynthesis. So if you slow that air exchange down, either because it's really humid and there's no reason for it to put water out into the atmosphere, or it's bone dry in the soils, that slowing down of transpiration is going to slow down carbon dioxide going into the plant. It's going to slow photosynthesis, it's going to slow the rate of growth. So just like our early season production, we put our fertility lens on. We say, you know what, we're going to go into a field. We're not going to irrigate. And we did irrigate a few spots on the farm. I'll tell you about that in a sec. But we're going to go into a field with plan, like the eggplants. You know, this whole section of the farm, there was never a plan to ever put irrigation on it. It's a field that's like maybe 600 or 800 feet long, and the beds are 200 feet across, and it's the furthest farm up on the hill from our core of our farm. So even if we put a well in, we're not running water out to those spots. So we put on our lens and we think about fertility for a second, and we say, well, what are we gonna do? If we're gonna talk about minerals, we're gonna talk about root growth, we're gonna absolutely emphasize phosphorus so that there's energy for plants to grow roots. That's all those boron, copper, and zinc, those things that help it. But there's also that full spectrum. Boron plays a role with silica that helps the sap pressure. That can make a big difference in respiration. It can make a big difference in photosynthesis. So the scientists, who's comfortable with this term water use efficiency? Has anybody spent time thinking about that? It's a technical term, not very technical, but it's basically looking at the photosynthetic rate versus how much water the plant used to get it where it needed to go. And partially what drove me down this curve of talking about quality of vegetables when I was in Hawthorne Valley, New York, I got to a point where I was like, we were having some crop quality issues. Even though we had been growing biodynamically and the soils had this beautiful compost added, you know, we had diseases in the fall. And I was like, well, why aren't we at the promised land? We've been farming there for 10 years. I want to get to the promised land. And I went down and listened to Neil Kinsey do a workshop, a three-day workshop at PASA. And one of the things that Neil Kinsey will talk about with potassium is it's poor man's irrigation. So the old timers call potassium poor man's irrigation. Why is that? You can go and look online. There's lots of studies. I got some links to them if you want to look at them. Potassium levels will impact water utilization. As simple as that. If you don't have adequate potassium in your crop, in your soil, maybe with the biology doing it, what it needs to do, then every drop of water that goes on that soil, whether it's irrigated or rainfall, is going to have a different capacity to make your crop grow. It's because the potassium plays a big role in controlling the stomata, which plays a big role in that respiration rate. So one of the very first things that we do, even though I don't like to push potassium because of quality perspective, you can just not necessarily achieve quality parameters if you're pushing potassium. The caveat is anytime we push potassium, we make sure we push calcium and magnesium along with it. But anytime we're going to go into a field that's not irrigated, we're going to make sure our potassium levels are adequate for that crop that year. And I don't mind putting a little bit of potassium sulfate fertilizer on to do that, 100 pounds to the acre, just to boost, make sure. Some of those research studies, and you know, obviously conventional agriculture, you have a hard time looking at the research because you don't really know what situation they're really functioning in, what kind of soil environment they're really functioning in, so you have to kind of take every research study you read with a grain of salt. But some of the water use efficiency studies out there with potassium were on high potassium soils in places like Texas, where there wasn't a shortage of potassium in the soil, it was a shortage of potassium actually being utilized by that plant. So the two major ones, the classic ones, if you're talking about water use efficiency, are potassium and zinc. Zinc sulfate, if you're short on zinc, for us that's 10 pounds to the acre, 20 pounds to the acre, depends on what kind of crop you're doing, depends on how much phosphorus you're pushing. Those are two minerals that we're always going to think about when we're thinking about farming in a dry situation. Or if irrigation water costs money. It's the full spectrum though, right? It's not just potassium and zinc. Calcium, I was so excited to hear John Slack talk about calcium at such length yesterday. Because over the years, you know, you talked about the biodynamic groups or the, you know, folks following different people. I've spent a lot of time following Kerry Reams and thinking about Kerry Reams' energies. And I don't fully still understand everything that Kerry Reams was talking about, but one thing that he pushed on and on and on and on, he said calcium was king, and he said calciums, you need multiple forms of calciums for your plants to be nutritious. So we've always had that lens when we operate the farm. Soft rock phosphate, high calcium limestone, gypsum, now we're bringing carbonatite on in addition to, you know, small amounts of eggshells and all kinds of things, and then the fungal activity to make that calcium available. There was an interesting study that I came across when I was preparing this that was looking at what happens to a plant that has good calcium levels versus what happens to a plant that's got poor calcium levels under drought conditions. And it has to do with how the cells shrink. And how those cells shrink, and once those cells shrink, how they lose communication between each other. And this is a classic thing, if you've heard people talk about potassium, it can give you big yield, but then if you like, you know, if you push a lot of potassium in your hay fields and you cut it down and it dries down to nothing, that's a good indication you haven't put your calcium there to keep the cells intact. The research study was basically putting out there that if you went through these dry spells, which we certainly go through, not irrigating, if your calcium levels are adequate, those cells don't shrink at the same level, and they can continue to have communication. And even more important, once they're rehydrated, they can go back and start working again. And if your calcium levels are deficient in that scenario, communication shuts down. So even though calcium's not on the list, that full spectrum calcium should be on the list. Now it's on the next one, which we're going to talk about xylem transpiration, right? You got xylem and your phloem. Xylem is where it's bringing all these nutrients and water up from the root systems. The classic rule of thumb is things like calcium, boron, and manganese are all minerals that are transported just through the xylem before they get complexed. It's not exactly entirely true, but the idea is most of the plants want to get those nutrients up from the root tips and take it up through that transpiration. So anytime transpiration slows, that could be a greenhouse that's really humid, that's not getting opened up in the springtime. That could be a really humid environment near the coast. That could be a really dry environment where the soil's dried out and there's not water to cycle through that plant. Anytime that transpiration slows down, these are those minerals that are going to be most likely to be deficient? Who here has had experience with either tip burn in cabbage or lettuce or blossom end rot in a tomato? Any or has seen that, right? It's classically known as a calcium deficiency, right? Partially why that's exhibited in the center part of a cabbage or the center part of a lettuce, the respiration rate of those leaves is very low compared to a leaf that's out. And that cycle of calcium through that respiration channel is not going to be anywhere near the degree it is if you're out on a leaf tip. And the same story with the fruit. The fruit is not having a respiration in the same degree that a leaf is. So those are the classic places where calcium is harder to mobilize. So all this talk about minerals, and of course there's always microbes, right? It's minerals, microbes, and management. So what do we do? There's a huge role in how you're managing your organic matter. And on the new land, we're not there yet, but what we're going to get back into is probably rotating maybe 20% of our land in a good solid fallow, hopefully for more than 12 months at a time, to really bring some active new organic matter into those soils. That can create a huge buffer going into these dry situations. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of documentation on mycorrhizae improving water availability in plants. If you're going to farm in dry land situations, inoculate with mycorrhizal, especially in all the species that take that. There's this other thing that happens in microbial situations where there's these dormancy of microbes when it's dry. There's actually situations sometimes where you can get a flush of nitrogen in a dry soil because the bacteria all die. So you have to be a little bit aware of that. That's a management action, and we saw that last year. We had a little bit of a flush of aphids. Probably it was maybe the first week of June, fourth week of May. Had some aphids on some of our early tomatoes and some aphids on our lettuce. We actually, I sent Nikki out to cut some lettuce mix, and she's like, this lettuce mix doesn't look good, there's some aphids in it. I looked at it, it had been planted about 2.5 weeks ago, was ready to be cut. And there, sure enough, there are aphids in it. I just forget about it. Take the lettuce mix off the harvest list. But when we saw the aphids and the tomatoes, it was sort of indication that maybe we had an imbalance that we had created. Right? We hadn't had hardly any water that was pushing nitrogen out of that soil. We had a lot of heat. So for us, our solution was a foliar spray that included things that we thought would help get that nitrogen out of the leaf. So Mark talked about magnesium. Put some Epsom salts in our foliar spray. Molybdenum is the key to the nitrate reductase enzyme, so we put sodium molybdate into that foliar spray. Real heavy dose, actually, from a foliar perspective. Interesting thing with that lettuce mix was we came back about 10 days later and it was, I don't know where the aphids had gone, but they were gone. We were able to cut lettuce mix. There were some lacewings and ladybugs around, but I don't know, they weren't really present on that lettuce mix. So we had taken away that nutrient source, that imbalance that was there, with some management. All right, remember that 6.5-inch rainstorm we got? What are we going to do with all that water? We want to think about how that water can infiltrate when we have our rainstorms. We want to think about how much of a capacity we have in our soils to collect that water. Organic matter. Building our organic matter is going to be the long-term key. 1% organic matter can hold about 27 gallons of water. It's about an acre inch. What that means is if you had a 3% organic matter soil versus 7% organic matter soil, you would have a much different water holding capacity just in those top 6 inches. We're not even talking about the lower horizons. Really good idea if you want to manage dry soils is to think about how to boost organic matter. One way that we do it sometimes is we do really thick, dense plantings of winter cover crops. This was probably rye that might have been thrown on at 200 pounds to the acre in mid-September. This was a picture from 2012. It went on to tomato land. We got a flail mower that year, which was like a really nice investment. Part of the idea is trying to improve photosynthesis. That time period between a crop that you no longer want and the cover crop being there, you want, that's a gap in photosynthesis, right? So we bought a flail mower that year so we could come in, and it was great. We literally got it probably a month before this picture. That day was experienced. It was our early tomatoes. They'd kind of kicked out. It was early September. I decided it's time to take them out. The crew started cutting strings like at 8 o'clock in the morning. It must have been a day we weren't harvesting. I came through with the flail once, broadcast the rye, did a light tillage, done. We may actually did probably some biobuilders there as well. That next year, and I looked to see if I had a good picture of this. I didn't, unfortunately. But that next year, this was on our wet fields, we turned that rye in probably around the first or second week of May. And the way it was is these tomato beds were set up, so we had, that year it was like tomato bed, and then a harvest lane that was like an early lettuce or beet crop, and then tomato bed, so on and so forth. And those harvest lanes that were supposed to be harvest lanes ended up being double cropped. So the way it worked in the fall is we ended up having like two beds of winter rye and then a bed that never got cover cropped because it was like a late lettuce or beet crop and then two beds of rye. So there's a really dynamic change from one spot to the other right next to each other. And the difference in that soil when it went through the dry spell that we had the following spring was so evident. You could see it from a distance with the coloration. Those beds that hadn't had that rye cover crop down, when it got dry in mid-May, they had that light brown color. They didn't have a nice depth of dark of color. But the beds that had that rye turned under, they kept that dark. So classic management for dry season. We're thinking about water infiltration. What are we going to do to capture that water? For me, a big one is deep tillage and helping to make sure our root systems can get down there. We have a field cultivator that can go down maybe 9 inches. We have a subsoiler if we need to go down that way. But we use the field cultivator a lot this year. My tiller broke like a year and a half ago, and I haven't replaced it yet. So occasionally I borrow it to friends. So this year we're doing a lot of disking and then just one or two passes with the field cultivator, partially to get some of these rocks up out of these fields. And we had some really good experience this year going through a relatively dry year. We did have those two rainstorms. But our best crop of mokum carrots that we've ever grown yield-wise was through this growing season. We had to let them mature. It took them maybe 7 to 10 days longer before we started picking them. I held them off because I wanted to make sure once we started picking them they were abundant. And we were getting like 2.5 pounds per row foot on these mokum carrots that are normally a nice skinny carrot. And the biggest difference with those carrots for us this year was having run that field cultivator through so that we had a carrot that was 9 inches long instead of a 6 or 7 inch carrot. And that field cultivator had gone through when there was also minerals put down so that there was feeding activity that could happen down there. Of course, tillage and compaction can make a huge difference. Long term, we're going to be talking about how we can manage to develop humus. Christine Jones talks about the liquid carbon pathway. A lot of that is about growing healthy plants, making sure the plants have enough phosphorus for the energy, for the sugars to be built in that system, and to cycle that boron to make sure the sugars can go down. We're talking about boron and potassium this afternoon. Mulching, right? Another classic technique to deal with irrigation or dry situations. Who here mulches? I know David said he mulched 2.5 acres last year with hay, but who here is mulching on a regular basis? Nice. If you can have the access to the materials, obviously the large-scale organic producers, they're all doing plastic because you can't afford the organic materials. Around us, a lot of the folks are moving away from plastic, the smaller producers like myself, and going to landscape fabric that you can get multiple years off of. It's a little bit of a pain in the butt to store, but you can have your holes burned. We did that this year for the first time with melons. So we had melons 2 foot spacing, landscape fabric down, and just planted our melons there. And we never even took the landscape fabric up. We'll just move it to our melon patch next year. There might be some rotation things that you might be concerned about, but normally we're focusing on fertility, so rotation's not an issue. We decided to mulch a little bit last year because, so we have this farm in relationship with an old hay farmer. And so I'm always in conversation with David, what can I do, you know, with work? And he had a field that he was planning to put back into hay, and it didn't get seeded down early enough. This was in 2012. And I said, well, if you put some winter wheat there, I'll buy whatever winter wheat you can grow as a mulch. So he did that, and he seeded some wheat for us. It was maybe an acre or so. And unfortunately, the timing of the harvest was not exactly great. but I told him I'd buy it from him, and he had got a chopper, so he chopped it up for us and just dumped it in the field, and we just took bushel bins and started mulching. So the reality of that is it requires a lot of material. So you have to have access to the material, and the transportation has to be appropriate. For us, what we did with that wheat, which was thin, it wasn't a huge stand. It kind of washed out, so its yield wasn't huge. But we ended up mulching all our early peppers, eggplants, tomatoes with it. We maybe mulched just under 10,000 square feet. And the lesson learned, not surprising, is that germinating wheat at a thick density will also start competing for nutrients if you have it on thick enough. So next year he reseeded that field with wheat again this year because he never got around to seeding it. So next year we're going to chop that wheat a little earlier so it doesn't become competition. We do a lot of, this maybe is controversial, but we do a lot of cultivation on the farm, a lot meaning one or two passes on most crops, three or four if they're long season crops. And I do kind of subscribe to this idea of dust mulching as being a good way to break the capillary action of the water going away from the farm when it's dry. Just real light cultivation, especially right after a rain, to kind of keep that separate dust mulch on top. Of course, dust becomes dust and can disappear from the farm. We haven't had too much of a problem with that during the growing season. I don't know if it's the soft rock or other stuff we're putting down that kind of holds the dust on the ground. But we did have one experience this January where we had more dust erosion than I've ever had, and it kind of cursed because we had a field that we didn't cover crop. And for us, January, it was really warm in December, and then we like went down like 40 degrees in 24 hours on like the 2nd or 3rd of January, and then we had like 50 or 60 mile per hour winds the next day. And I was at a meeting at a neighboring farm that day, and I was watching the dust leave the farm, and I was just like, oh, geez. And then I talked to the landowner where we rent from. She said, you're losing a lot of your soil that day. So, you know, dust mulching can be appropriate at certain times of the year. Obviously not recommended for the winter. All right, so remember that picture of that eggplant that was under row cover? And that was, I think, taken like June 29th or something like that. This is the same eggplant July 30th. So it did have the benefit of two rainstorms, that big, heavy rainstorm. Although it's on a pretty good slope, so that 6-inch rainstorm, it probably only got, you know, an inch and a half or 2 inches of that. And then the next one, it went down. But here it is, right? Completely unirrigated eggplant. We had our best eggplant crop we've had in maybe 4 or 5 years this year. What was the key to that for us? One of the big ones was we kept that row cover on as long as we possibly could, making sure that it had the heat that it needed, because we're not in a really warm environment, and it likes that heat. We also, I should tell you that this field had never been under our management until last year, never had any fertility applied before April of this year. So, you know, this crop was not a crop that we, this is a good example of, like, let's hit the gas and go with it year one. Right? At the end of the year, the CSA members that liked eggplant, they gave us rave reviews for eggplant this year. The ones that didn't said it was maybe a little too much early in the season. We decided, I've never grown sweet corn in a long time. I've grown sweet corn twice in my life before this summer. But we had a pea crop that didn't do well. It was cold spring, so I was trying to think of what would be a nice way to tell our CSA members, you didn't get peas, but you got something instead. So I thought, let's grow some sweet corn. I've always thought sweet corn didn't make sense economically. I know Chris Yoder and some other guys do it on scale. I said, well, let's transplant some sweet corn and see what it is. It was a thinking I had about a year and a half ago. We haven't put it in place yet, but my vision is for us to go towards cover cropping that are cover crops that are edible, but we're growing them in places where we wouldn't think to grow them otherwise for benefits beyond just the edibility of that crop. So my vision for next year is we will grow maybe a half acre of sweet corn, but we're going to grow it, we're going to feed it well, we're going to grow it as much as we can for the stock as a cover crop, and then the financial value of, we don't care what we get for the price of the sweet corn, because that's an added bonus. We're going to do this. The plan is to do this long term with beans. I've always felt like beans, you know, it's such a pain in butt to pick beans. But if you have good yields, you can pick pretty quickly. So what we're going to do with beans next year, we had plans to do it this year, but we never ahead of the game enough to do it, is we're going to probably plant a half acre of string beans. We'll be running them out every 7 or 10 days, and so that anytime we need to pick beans, it's just that first time through the field, quick as can be, and that bean is just a cover crop. So we're thinking about this, it's my selfishness of trying to think about how we're going to make money to be farming, right? I don't make money, our family doesn't make money except for on the farm. So it's not like we have some other resource. So the sweet corn experiment worked really well. We hit some lucky windows. I talked to conventional growers. Their spray windows were really light when the sweet corn was maturing, which was the first week of August for us. And the CSA customers tended to like it. We tried two successions. The second succession wasn't as great. So with that sweet corn, that was ambrosia. We picked it over about a 11-day window. And it was really just that final picking that had maybe a percentage of earworms that were above of maybe every 10th ear. But that's what I was saying is I think we just hit the window where there wasn't a lot of moth flight taking place. We're gonna find out this year. You know, the theory is, of course, healthy crops don't have insects. The reality of that is, like, there's certain things, like, we've rarely had Colorado potato beetles be a problem. We've rarely had cucumber beetles. Cucumber beetles aren't a problem on our farm. They mainly get excited by the decaying flowers in the squash plants if they fly in, right? That's where they like to go and get into the flowers. We still have some flea beetle pressure, but insect pressure hasn't been a problem over the years. Partially because I think we focus on making sure that protein is fully getting there, sulfur, those kind of things. So the experiment, just to give you an idea, and this is an experiment we will not repeat, we're talking about celery this afternoon. We also tried growing celery, which we did harvest some celery, it was pretty rough, unirrigated as well. Celery loves water. We know this, but I grow celery every year because I like the taste of it, even if it's kind of strong flavor. We have the capacity to run some drip, we'll probably run some drip just for a celery crop next year just to see what we can do yield-wise. You can talk to Glenn, you probably had some of it. It's probably strong flavored celery. That's a good way to describe it. If you are using water and you want to get a little better handle of that, you know, understanding irrigation, number one, water testing is really, I think, incredibly important because if you're putting a lot of irrigation down, that can have a huge role in impacting nutrient availability through the season. What's that water quality like? I normally like to go to dry places to find out about irrigation because I don't think our land-grant universities really understand irrigation all that well in New England. And my two favorite resources, University of Florida, almost anything if you want to get into irrigation, University of Florida is my go-to. And I don't know if they still, I always hear bad things about Florida. We're going to go there for vacation. I have relatives there next week. In terms of how they support public education. But apparently they somehow have a network that still supports their extension services because they do a ton of research, obviously, for the agricultural industry as it relates to irrigation. They have dozens and dozens of things, and well, check that out. Colorado State's got a really nice piece on irrigation scheduling, looking at kind of this idea of water balancing, how much water you need based on soil temperatures, evaporation rates, all those kinds of things. I think, you know, down the road, we will irrigate on our farm. We actually did, I ran drip on maybe 20 beds once or twice in the height of the summer this year because we really hit a dry spot and I just was feeling a little too nervous. But long term, here's my thinking. If you're using T-tape and headers and all those things, there's a cost associated with putting that drip out and there's a cost associated with the actual plastic materials. Most of that, unless you're using thicker grade stuff, is single use, maybe 2-year use stuff. It's not going to be there long term. For me, I was always rather investing in these minerals that I thought were going to be there long term, that are going to help the whole system function, rather than always investing. We got a ton of drip irrigation, we just don't often put it down. But if you are irrigating, I think we can do a much better job as farmers of being thoughtful about how we're running our irrigation cycles, making sure that we're really developing root systems that we want to develop. If you're sourcing materials, I want to pull out a couple things, which is The Progressive Grower is a company down in West Wareham, and my neck of the woods doing a lot more with organic production stuff, so it's a nice opportunity for some organic materials in addition to the bulk order, of course.
Excuse me, is that in the...
That's in the reader, yep. For the home gardeners, when we start talking about trace minerals, sometimes complications, right? It gets complicated. Manganese, copper, all those kinds of things. We've been recommending the last couple years, Peaceful Valley has really cheap shipping, all things considered. They're in California. But, you know, they market a BioLink micronutrients. It's got a bunch of, it's all sulfate forms. It's not like super fancy stuff, but it's got all that stuff. It's relatively cheap. A jug of that for your home garden, and you got all your traces you need whenever you need them. I mean, it's not all the traces, but it does have molybdenum. A lot of traces don't have that kind of stuff. For microbes, I want to talk briefly kind of what we're doing on our farm, which is, so we've yet to find a neighbor that I kind of really want the cow shit from. I kind of wish that I had somebody. I got a few neighbors, but a lot of them, the people that are doing cows right in our neighborhood tend to be people that are rotational grazing and, you know, don't collect their shit. The long-term plan is for us to build a bedding pack shed, loafing shed in our farm and find somebody to run beef cattle on that property, and then we can have a little bit of a source of that. But so absent that material, I've always felt like that transportation of organic matter, I want to try to build that on our farm in the farm rather than transport it from off the farm. So what we do is we try to think a lot more along the lines of inoculation. We're doing a lot of work with barrel composts, which is kind of a classic Maria Thune recipe in the biodynamic world. It's basically 5-gallon bucket of cow manure, some basalt. I learned about basalt this morning, and some eggshells. And if you really want to get exciting, some actual biodynamic preps. Throw all those into a barrel that's sunken into the earth, mix it all up, let it do its thing. So we've been making barrel compost the last 3 or 4 years. I feel like I'm just now starting to actually get to the point where I'm making halfway decent barrel compost. It's kind of fun. And we're make maybe 30 gallons of it a year. Its application rate a lot of times is you're putting on like a cup to a backpack as like a tea inoculant. You know, so we got more than we need just off of one barrel in the ground that we're cycling through. Those biodynamic preps, for the people that aren't, you know, as familiar with them, there's a lot of stuff within biodynamics that's about energetics, and it's about kind of taking in astral forces and things that, depending on where you fall on the spectrum of that, it can be a little bit discomforting. There's also a ton of what is in the basic practices inherent to biodynamics, especially as they relate to preps, which is really about microbial inoculation. And there's some good books that Pfeiffer published, some of the research that he was doing, where he was looking at various prep inoculated piles through composting and ones that had been exposed to certain preps, and looking at how mineral analysis within those preps afterwards would change dramatically based on what type of microbial populations were introduced to those preps. So for me, the cost of, whether it's from Hugh Courtney or from Laura or from JPI, the cost of bringing in preps, because I'm not making them ourselves, to inoculate my barrel compost is like such a simple, cheap investment. And we might get into the astral qualities of all this stuff as well, but really, at the base, it's an inoculant. And, you know, so we've been using biodynamic preps since we started the farm. Some years we do it really well, and some years we fall off the wagon. It sort of depends on how busy we are. And the quote that struck me that I came across this last year, and I'm trying to think of where I came across it, was, you know, the thing about biodynamic preps is, this was from a practitioner, says, they always work as long as you use them. And that just that reminder of that inoculation. And for me, let's think about this, right? We're doing tillage, we're doing all these things. We got, you know, we're also doing some stuff with Korean natural farming a little bit, you know, not nearly to the degree. We had Nikki doing that, but she didn't quite get there. Whoever works with me next year maybe gets into that. We're doing a lot of that work. The barrel compost, there's really good evidence around that humus formation. And really what we're trying to do is encourage that microbial population that are good at forming humus, and then we're going to take that out over our land. And it gets sprayed out a couple times out of the year. So If anyone wants to talk about biodynamics later on, feel free to catch my ear. We don't call ourselves, we don't market ourselves anything biodynamic. It might say that somewhere on our farm website to talk about the principles. We have cow horns, so we can make our own 500 and 501 and clay horn manure compost, things like that, but we're not following what I would say is a biodynamic protocol. And then it's really about management, right? Microbes are important, minerals are important, but it's ultimately about management. And a couple things that I think about, I always think of us as being on this continuum. We're nowhere near there. Last year, we farmed like 7 acres. Nikki, who was working with Mission down in California, it was just her and I till like the first week of July, plus a little bit of workshare labor, without equipment. Like, that's not really smart management to be understaffed. But, you know, we moved the farm. We weren't sure how the farm stand was going to move. We didn't want to, like, get ourselves caught in a cash flow situation. So we did what we did. Thinking about how you're going to introduce management throughout the growing season as it relates to fertility is, I think, one of the biggest steps to kind of start to reformulate your paradigm. And, you know, listening to Brian, he talked about, you know, all of a sudden we're not cultivating. Cultivating doesn't really build, I mean, it does oxygenate environments and help mineralize stuff, but it doesn't build fertility in a long-term situation. That's work. That's not building that fire. So we think about that, and the way we do it on our farm is, our farm stands open 7 days a week. We have CSA twice a week. We still structure into our growing season a morning a week where we have most of the crew not harvesting. Wednesday mornings are fertility fun morning, right? It's the morning where we're going to go. That's the morning that we did our foliar spray and molybdenum in June. We structured that in. We planned for that work. It's real common in home gardeners. You do all your fertility work in April, and then you plant your crops, and then you're kind of done with your fertility work. It's also pretty common on farms. I did my fertility work, right? I spread my compost in the winter. I did it. You take that fertility management out of the growing season. And yet if we think about all the work that we're doing in the growing season, I would sort of argue that if we can build a little bit of fertility management into the growing season, we can be better managers and we can get more return. It's, if I'm doing consulting work with larger farms, this is a very obvious thing, but some large farms struggle with it still. If you're a large farm that relies on mechanical cultivation, I think it's critical that you have the capacity for somebody to be cultivating no matter what day of the week it is. You need to have somebody who can cultivate on a tractor on a harvest morning. If you don't, you're going to have the potential to miss your cultivation windows, and you're going to have a tool that's not going to be effective to you. This is the same idea, is that if we want to have these practices available, if you at all care of micro-manipulations of boron plays a huge role in making sure you get good pollen tube development, you get good flower development, you get fruit production. If you want to micromanage your boron, you have to figure out a way to build that into your management structure on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a seasonal basis. And then for me, the financial viability, it's critical for us to be profitable. And, you know, so this year, we're not a very large farm. Somebody asked me, I think Eva actually, in the car the other day said, well, is it viable to farm on a small scale? It's a constant question, right? And my response was, well, if we don't have to pay for health insurance, yes. The reality for us, we've got family, if we wanted to buy a private health care insurance plan, it'd be $20,000 to $25,000 a year. It would raise the price of our CSA shares maybe $150. That would price us out of the marketplace in our area. So we qualify for MassHealth, and the reality is we will probably always qualify for MassHealth because we will figure out a way in a cash economy, farm economy, to put whatever income we need into a different place than Schedule F. Right? I sometimes wonder, because I was talking with an accountant about this, I'm like, how much can I talk about honest situations with accountants? And I'm like, well, I haven't paid this accountant to do anything for me, so I will be honest. Like, the reality of the situation is, if we make 40 grand a year, or a little bit less, we can qualify for MassHealth. And if we make 60 grand a year, we're going to have to pay our own way on health insurance to some degree, and have to pay taxes. And they did research down in Pennsylvania. and I was quoting this, where they looked at a single mom who was making $28,000 a year, qualified for health subsidies, qualified for housing subsidies, so on and so forth, and they looked at a single mom making $62,000 a year, and the single mom making $28,000 a year had a better quality of life, meaning they had more income at their disposal to buy things than the one making more. So we as small farmers, I think that's one of the biggest challenges, in this huge thing that says, if you want to make a bunch more money, you're going to have to pay a lot more taxes, right? So instead, you're going to invest it in equipment, you're going to invest it in paying your employees better, that skilled labor part of things, right? That's a critical piece of the equation. It's not going to necessarily be, unfortunately, the government. That's the reality of things. Final point. Common sense can carry you a long ways. Anything that you're doing on the farm. Observation, to me, is the key. And I had a conversation with Russell Libby, the late director of MOFCA, on a trip a number of years ago, and we were talking about, he'd done a lot of work looking at the economics of small farms, and he sort of was pretty set when he was telling me, he says, you know what, I think when you look at the future of agriculture in New England, a lot of it's going to be hobby scale production, because the economics don't make sense. And I said, well, you know what, the problem with the hobby scale production, not that I have nothing wrong with hobby scale production, because we can learn so much from producers that have that free time. But the problem that I see it is I want as many farmers farming full time year round, or having the time to have vacation in the winter to do things to get perspective, because I want people engaging in the active agriculture as much as possible so that we can develop insights. And that having that observational experience. I was talking to somebody yesterday, I said, in some perfect world, we'd all be wholesaling for the people that are like me that maybe don't want to talk with our customers and getting a good price, because then we could really focus on what we want to do, which is grow the best damn food possible. The grand scheme of things, like it's nice to send a CSA newsletter out, but I don't really want to spend a bunch of time doing those kinds of things. I really want to be solely focused on growing really, really, really good food. The joy of all this, of course, is And I took a little bit of issue with David wanting to have nutritional quality analysis and how important that may or may not be. I think it's really important on a larger scale. For a small scale, we don't have we have sort of no need to get new market share for our scale of farm. We've structured it, and whether we'd be at this scale 5 or 10 years down the road, we've structured it so that it's very non-mechanized, because I like to use my body. It's also a great way to teach people how to farm if they're interacting with the crop on a regular basis. But we've now, you know, had the farm for 6 or 7 years, and now we're at a place where, you know, we do like to have new customers, but it's not like we're out there trying to find new customers in a grand scheme of things. And I think anybody who's focusing on quality parameters, it is so easy to find people to buy your vegetables over time, because that quality parameter is it's dramatically different. We were kind of lucky and blessed to have really low standards in Dartmouth before I moved there. And I mean, I'm being perfectly honest, there just wasn't, I mean, there still is. Like, we literally had somebody join our CSA this year halfway through the season who was engaged with another CSA, said, well, we're going to just stop picking up there and join your CSA if you have a share. And I said, we were actually full, but I was convinced that this person would be a long-time customer. So I was like, yeah, we'll make room for you if you want to join at the end of August. The good thing is we have now a nice cohort that we got a bunch of neighbors that are doing good stuff, and the quality is going up, we're all rising up, and the South Coast is going to be a good place. I want to mention real quick, we're going to do a workshop series at our farm this year, March 22nd, June 14th, September 13th. It's a season-long workshop, all Sunday afternoons, kind of hands-on slash looking at this idea of growing vegetables for health, quality, and profit. And for people that like to listen to people speak, Jeff Lowenfels is going to be down in Rhode Island on March 29th, they're having their winter conference at the end of the winter, and kind of a neat opportunity as well. And there it is. So, I don't know where Gary is. Okay. So, we start a little bit late, so I think we have about 10 minutes for questions, is what Glenn said, and so let's go for that. So the question about using biodynamic preparations and a compost tea?
No, as a mix-in for compost tea ingredient.
A mix-in as a compost tea ingredient. We do it. I mean, the traditional biodynamics likes to keep things sort of separate in a certain regard. But I bring compost teas into our biobuilders, like I was saying, and we're sometimes, we do a lot of stirring and energizing of our compost teas. It's a big thing in biodynamics. A lot of it's just oxygenating the bacteria to get the bacteria going, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think it's totally worth doing. The key with compost teas, I think it's only as good as the compost. And so, you know, a good prep has got some really good biology to it as well. So, those, Hugh separated from JPI, Laura's at a different farm in Kentucky. All three of those are great options if you want to just try practicing buying in stuff, so, biodynamics. So we traditionally on our farm will side dress crops if we feel like two things need to happen. Either we need to speed along production or prolong either the harvest or the keeping quality in the field. And a lot of times we're just use what I call like our energy fertilizer. Last year we're using a lot of Crayers, which is an organic, organically approved composted chicken manure from New York. But Dan's Spring Blend or Pro Grow or Pro Start, I kind of like those all-in-ones. If I don't want to do that, alfalfa meal is a nice one that we use a lot of times as well. Its price fluctuates, so sometimes I go back and forth. We decided to put it back into our plan this year because at, you know, 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet, we're talking about a side dress application, we're not talking about a huge amount. Blood meal, I mean, one of the things in that observation is so critical for me is like, go out and experiment, go out and kind of check things out. So we did that with that blood meal and that cabbage crop. We also did that with blood meal and the lettuce head. That lettuce head might have come out from that blood meal field. I'm not sure, because we had three beds and I ran blood meal into one of those beds. And just to see, you know, what is the difference between putting on the rate of what works out to be maybe 150 pounds of blood meal on as a side dressing versus not doing it. What does that make a difference? Is nitrogen a limiting factor for growth at that time of year? But it could be nitrogen, it could be phosphorus, it could be running a foliar with boron, you know, all those kinds of things. I should mention, so this field, we had this brand new field, that winter squash picture is a 4-acre field. We picked out a ridiculous amount of rocks, like at least 20 or 30 tons that we lifted into a dump trailer, and probably two or three times that much that David pulled out with his backhoe. So we spent a lot of time picking rocks this year. So next year's crop's gonna be a little better because we're not gonna have time to manage for that, we're gonna manage for fertility. But what we did, and this was partially informed because, you know, Elaine Ingham was out and she's kind of anti all this bringing stuff in. Normally when I go into a new field, I like to have a piece that's my check and control. So that's what we did, is we had a little section, it was about 4,000 or 5,000 square feet, got nothing. And it showed it. It showed it in terms of the quality and the yield, especially it is brassicas that got diseased really quickly in the fall, and some radishes that really didn't size up. And that was a worst case scenario. That field, you know, no fertility whatsoever. But if you think about something, try and hold something aside and don't do it and see if it gives you things. If you're in the biodynamic community, it's hard because if you spray here, like 50 feet away is getting impacted. So from an energetic standpoint, it's really hard to have controls. But yeah, any other questions? Yeah, I think alfalfa meal, actually the Fedco has been carrying GMO-free alfalfa meal for at least the last 2 or 3 years. They've been labeling it as such. So I would assume that they will keep that relationship alive. That's probably your best bet. Blood meal is a tricky situation because the reality is, I mean, unless you're getting blood meal from a local abater, you know, that you know something about those animals, yeah, the reality is like the blood meal is coming from feedlot animals. And there's a push and a go. Nitrogen is in every single cell. It's the key to growth. And we want to have that growth present. In a perfect world, we can get a lot of that. Like, you know, this is that idea of the time of year makes a big difference, right? A lot of times the fall brassicas, they never get fertility. For arugula crop that's going down in August and September, that soil's dramatically different in August and September than it is on May 1st. And so we're going to manage differently. And for us, we're willing to use a little bit of blood or something else. And over time, the customer base in our cohort, very few of them are so diehard that they even get to ask those questions. It's not just because I'm not in the CSA tent, but I think it's just that it's off the radar. And also there builds a trust relationship between folks over time. And then also a quality issue gets there. You know, like, I've had crops that aren't worth putting on the farm stand. I mean, first year we started the farm, we didn't direct market anything because I didn't want to have my name behind a product that I wasn't confident in. I had no idea what we were going to do that first year. And we still have situations, or a lot of times with the CSA, like, we're label it. If it's something that we think is not par, we're going to say, you know, here it is, it's bonus second quality. Most of the time we label something second quality and people laugh at us because they're like, this isn't second quality. And you're like, oh no, it is. You know, you find a little dot here, something like that. Yeah. So any other final questions? So for me, that's really a question of the time of the year and how much that biological system can really function. And in the early stages of our land, especially like these are some of the soils that we're planting that have never had any of our management on them, I don't feel like that natural nitrogen system is circulating in such a way that we have enough to promote real vigorous growth in the springtime. Long term, we will be able to get away from using nitrogen inputs to some degree, but my guess is that if I want to push, like I like to have a nice head of cabbage by the first, by like the 10th of June every year, so that we can give somebody, you know, CSA, I like to have that first or second CSA distribution have more than just light wheat greens. So that could be a personal challenge to figure out how to grow a nice head of cabbage by the 10th of June without any additional nitrogen inputs. But my guess is we'd be doing something to stimulate that biology. Row cover, as I mentioned to Julie, is something that we often recommend for early season producers. Long term, we've done a lot with long season fallows. At Hawthorne Valley, we'd go clover with 18 months. And I mean, a good stand of vetch will give you all the nitrogen you need, really, you know? So it's just a matter of how that fits into your cycle. You all do a lot with pea greens, and I've never done pea greens. I've never wanted to do pea greens, except occasionally I'm like, well, maybe I should just do pea greens so that I can, you know, not use nitrogen. Yeah, there'd be a big nitrogen source for the ensuing crop, and then the customers, I'm sure, would love pea greens. But so, all right, one final question. So the question was about tailoring our management practice of the biodynamic calendar. The reality of that calendar is that it, you know, was based, like Maria Thun's calendar was based on her research in Switzerland that worked, and there's been various people, and there's actually a whole biodynamic research crowd that follows with that and tries to do some replications. And sometimes it hasn't been shown to be the case that it's provided a real life actual response. And in fact, Steve, who farms down the road at Friends Academy, ran some radish tests for me one year where he was doing radishes on every like 6 days or 3 days or whatever, and the yields were better around the radishes that were seeded before the full moon, didn't have to do with the root cycle. Now, if it's the soil getting tuned into biodynamics, there's another question there. What I will say is we follow the biodynamic calendar in our greenhouse, even though I just told you that. It's partially because if you actually use a Stella or one of those calendars, they're built on these lunar cycles that are cycled through the four root crops, you know, root, leaf, so on and so forth, fruit and flower, on like a 7 to 10 day rotation. And it just kind of gives you this like really nice rhythm to greenhouse work in the springtime. Once you get to the harvest season, the reality is like, our harvest season means we know exactly what we're doing, you know, half the work week, because we're harvesting in the morning time almost every day. And so getting into cycles there, we sometimes get a little bit less. I tend to focus more, because I'm not irrigating, in all honesty, I will try and hit full moon cycles for germination. But that full moon and germination has really only been proven if there's soil moisture. And for us, a lot of times, like if we're growing carrots without irrigation, we're going to look a lot more at, like, even if we get a quarter inch of rain, we're going to use that a lot more than the calendar. So, all right, I believe it's now probably the time for people to do, like, lunch type stuff. Yeah.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.